Graphic Audio, a movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Templar Chronicles Book 4, Infernal Games, by Joseph Nassis. Narrated by Terrence Aselford. With performances by David Coyne, Thomas Penny, Alexander Strain, Bradley Smith, Nora Ashrati, Mort Shelby, Thomas Keegan, Christopher Graybill, Ken Jackson, Alyssa Wilmoth, Matthew Bassett, Richard Rowan, Eric Messner, Stephen Carpenter, Tim Getman, Michael Glenn, Evan Casey, Colleen Delaney, and Scott McCormick. Simon Logan lay on the cot in the corner of his cell, listening to the voices of the dead whisper to him from out of the darkness. Their voices helped him, sustained him. They lifted him out of the depth of his despair and gave him the courage he needed to face each day as if it were not identical to the one before it and the one before that, and so on, back through an endless succession of such periods, the sterility of prison life blurring into one long, endless repetition of the same activities that were designed to break his will and turn him into an obedient little prisoner. The voices were his sanity and his salvation. And while he listened, the dead told him things, important things, things he couldn't have known otherwise. The dead were his friends, you see. The whisper of their voices like the caress of a lover in the depths of the night. They told him of the world outside these walls, of the events that transpired there while he was locked away in that meager 8x8-foot space. And in turn, he gave them tasks to perform, orders to carry out, providing a purpose and direction for their existence that they thought had been lost forever. It was the perfect symbiotic relationship. The wards, bindings, and other enchantments built into the walls of his cell kept him from doing anything more than speaking with the dead. But speaking with them was enough for now. Logan lay on his bunk in the darkness, conserving his energy, knowing he was going to need it, if the voices were right, if today was, indeed, his day of salvation. It was still early afternoon when the voices told him that the guards were headed in his direction. His cell had no clock, and this far underground there wasn't a window to let him judge the passage of the sun across the sky. But he knew what time it was just the same. He'd always been able to sense the coming of darkness for decades, and right now his senses were telling him that darkness was still many hours away. That was fine. He was patient. He could wait. He thanked the dead for their service and then sent them on their way with the messages he had prepared for just this eventuality. The time had come. He could feel it in his bones. The lights flashed on suddenly, harsh and blinding. The move designed to disorient, perhaps even to cause physical pain. He was abruptly thrust from the utter darkness of long days spent in solitary confinement, but he had been forewarned, and so was not caught by their petty game. Sitting on his bunk, with his eyes held gently shut, when the flare of brilliance chased away the darkness. There were 9 of them, an auspicious number.
Assume the position.
The guard captain was nervous. Logan could smell his fear from 5 feet away. It made him want to smile, but he made sure to keep the grin off his face and his expression carefully neutral. Anything else would simply earn him a beating.
All right.
He got up from his bunk and crossed to the door of his cell. Turning around, he slid his hands through the waist-high slot.
Okay, you know the drill. Back off.
Logan followed the duty captain's orders, pulling his hands back out of the slot and stepping away from the door. They formed up around him, with the duty captain to his left, holding his arm, and the others arrayed in groups of 4 before and behind him. When the duty captain gave the signal, they led him down the hall and then up the 3 flights of stairs to the general population level. The raucous noise that usually filled the cavernous space quieted as they realized who was being brought up. Soon, all of the other inmates were standing at the fronts of their cells, staring in silence at the procession as it made its way slowly past. Even in here, amidst the worst of the Order's enemies, the man once known only as the Necromancer commanded respect and fear. It had been just over 2 months since Logan had requested an audience with Knight Commander Cade Williams and given him information that had eventually led to the confrontation with the Chang'e and the deaths of dozens of Templar soldiers. For his part in the process, he'd been transferred to solitary confinement and left to rot alone in the darkness with barely enough food to survive. Rather than break him, however, the change in circumstances had proved to be a boon. No longer haunted by the ghost of Cade's dead wife, Gabrielle, the necromancer had slowly begun to recover and was now in better physical condition than he had been since arriving at the prison. The guards took him through general population and then up 5 more levels, passing through a checkpoint each time until they reached the ground floor. There, they went through a successive series of checkpoints until, nearly a half an hour after they started, the group stood near the massive double doors leading to the main entrance and the transport yard just beyond. The duty captain stepped forward, a rubber ball gag, the kind favored by S&M enthusiasts, with straps that allowed the gag to be pulled tight and secured around the back of the head in one hand. He held it up for the prisoner to see.
Open up!
For a second, Logan hesitated. It was more a result of being startled by something so out of the ordinary than any real objection to the request, but that second was enough. The duty captain had been waiting for an excuse to cause his prisoner some misery, and that was all he needed. Logan didn't fight back. It would only escalate into a beating, and he didn't want to take the chance of being injured right now. The gag and handcuffs were redundant inside the prison, as the wards built into the very foundations of the building kept him from accessing his power in any significant way. So the use of the restraints now indicated that they were taking him outside the gates, most likely as part of a transfer to a new facility. After spending the last 6 months locked away beneath the ground in solitary confinement, the idea of walking out those doors was almost daunting. Almost. The duty captain moved to a window made of bulletproof glass.
What do you got, Charlie?
Transfer to Longford post-trial. There to remain until the end of time.
Yeah, we can only hope, right?
Apparently, Logan had been tried and found guilty in absentia. He certainly hadn't attended any proceedings of that type in the last 2 months. He thought of the promise Knight Commander Williams had made to him several months before. A view of the sunlight before the end of his trial. That had been the deal. Papers were passed over, signed, and passed back again. When all was in order, the group was allowed to proceed through the checkpoint to the final barrier, a thick set of double doors made of reinforced concrete. A lobby, like one found in most modern business buildings, was just beyond the doors, part of the cover the order had set up around the facility. Security guards stationed behind the information booth eyed him curiously as he was marched past, but they knew better than to speak to him. Logan barely gave them a passing glance as his attention was fixed firmly on his destination. A transport bus was waiting outside. The guards didn't hesitate, just hustled him out the doors into the cold February snow and over to the waiting vehicle. The driver opened the bus doors as they approached, so the group didn't have to slow down as they led him up the steps. It wasn't much to look at, just a chair welded to the floor inside a box of bulletproof glass. But the moment that he was shoved into the seat, he felt the bindings that were etched into the walls around him. Bindings designed to keep him from using his powers against those on the other side of the glass. He was like a newborn babe, naked and unprotected from those who might wish him harm. Or so they thought. Two guards stepped inside the box with him and quickly wrapped him in several sets of thick iron chains, which the duty captain then secured with a special set of blessed padlocks. Their job finished, the guards stepped out of the enclosure and closed the door of the box behind them, securing that with a lock as well. Satisfied that all was as it should be, the guards moved several seats forward and sat down facing the front of the bus, their weapons by their sides. The necromancer wanted to laugh at the theatrics. He missed his old nemesis. Had Williams been in charge, he would have been drugged into unconsciousness, bound with silver, and sealed inside a protective circle before they would have even thought about taking him from his cell. This lot was making things far too easy. He glanced out the window at the place where he had just spent the last 6 months of his life. The innocuous little building known to the Order as the Bennington Containment Facility looked more like a public high school than a maximum security prison for offenders of some of the world's worst evils. But that was hardly a surprise. The Templars had had centuries to perfect the art of hiding in the open, and even he had to admit that they did it quite well.
Let's roll!
The first 3 hours passed without incident. Logan had long ago learned the art of sitting patiently, and he practiced that now as he waited for the right time. At first, the guards were tense, constantly looking over their shoulders in his direction, as if he might pull a Harry Houdini and escape from his bonds right before their very eyes. But as time passed, and he remained securely bound, they began to relax. Relaxation eventually turned to boredom, and boredom to complacency. Logan felt them long before seeing them, their presence like a beacon in the night to one with his powers. He prepared himself for what was to come, knowing there would be a moment of vulnerability when the guards might think of opening his cell and shooting him in the head rather than taking the chance that he might escape into the world once more. He didn't expect them to have enough presence of mind to think of it, but better safe than sorry. He focused inward, centering himself and gathering what power he could just in case he would need it. Several moments later, the headlights picked up the first wispy strands of a low-lying fog creeping along the road, but the driver barely noticed. The suddenly changing temperatures at this time of year often caused a bit of ground fog, and he gave it no mind as he continued forward, unaware that in doing so, he'd just committed everyone aboard to the events which were to follow. 100 yards down the road, the fog had risen to cover the wheels of the bus, and the driver was starting to grow a little concerned. It had grown thicker as well as higher, limiting the driver's ability to see any obstacles that might be in the road ahead of him, and he naturally slowed the vehicle down as a result. It never occurred to him to wonder where fog like this had come from on such a cold night. Noting the change in speed, the duty captain came forward and crouched down beside the driver.
What is the delay?
I can't see shit. If I hit something at this speed, we're gonna be in serious trouble. Better to slow down now than pay for it later.
All right. It's your bus, you know what's best. Just get us there.
I'll do my...
The loss of power meant the steering and brakes reverted to manual control, and the driver suddenly found himself trying to steer a 12-ton behemoth rolling forward at just over 25 miles per hour. To their right was a forest of thick pine. To their left, the yawning mouth of a narrow ravine. The driver did not want a closer look at either. The muscles on his arms stood out as he strained to hold the vehicle on course. He pumped the brakes frantically with both feet in an effort to get the bus to slow down and come to a stop.
Give me a hand!
The duty captain jumped to his aid, grabbing the wheel with both hands and adding his strength to the driver's. Between the two of them, they were able to keep the bus on the road and pointed in the right direction until it slowly ground to a halt several long and tense minutes later. That's when they noticed the fog. No longer content to lie clinging to the ground in slowly drifting pools and eddies, this fog seemed to have a life of its own. It had sprung up like a wall all about them, leaving a clear patch of ground roughly 10 feet on all sides of the bus, so that they seemed to be sitting in a special little clearing of their own. The fog twisted and turned, churning about, and both men would have sworn that they saw faces in its depths, gray, distorted shapes with black, bottomless holes for eyes and mouths opened wide in silent screams. Movement of a different sort within the depths of the fog became clearer as an individual in a long black robe stepped out in front of the bus, his face hidden in the depths of his hood.
What the hell?
As if in response, the newcomer reached up, grasped the edges of his hood, and pulled it back, revealing his face to the men on the bus.
Sweet Mother Mary!
The coarse black thread that had been used to sew his lips and eyes shut, precautions used to keep him from seeing or speaking in the afterlife, stood out in stark contrast to the light gray coloration of his dead flesh, while the glint of metal in his ears marked where molten silver had been poured into place to keep him from hearing. The living watched as the dead man lifted an arm and pointed at the bus. The duty captain turned his head just in time to see something monstrous emerge from the fog on the right side of the bus. The bus slid sideways for several yards, stopping just inches away from the edge of the embankment. The captain didn't pay attention to the chaos. His gaze was locked on that of the prisoner in the back of the bus, the prisoner who couldn't speak around the gag placed in his mouth. The bus careened over the edge of the embankment. Night Captain Matthew Riley, acting commander of the Echo Team, stood at the edge of the embankment and stared down at the wreckage in the ravine several hundred feet below. It looked as if the driver had lost control of the bus on the icy road and, unable to stop the oversized vehicle, had careened off the embankment and into the ravine. The dents in the sides and roof of the bus showed it had rolled several times on its way down the embankment before coming to rest with its nose rammed into a large outcropping of rock, the impact hard enough to push the engine block halfway into the cab. Riley knew looks could be deceiving, however. It had been 2 months since Night Commander Cade Williams had come stumbling out of the beyond with Riley's near-dead body in his arms, the two of them crashing through the mirror in the surgical prep room of the Templar Commandery in Arlington, Virginia. Thankfully, the medical staff sprang into action immediately and as a result managed to save Riley's life. Not only had he lived to see another day, but the faith healers who had treated him shortly thereafter had been able to cut his healing time down from several months to just a couple of weeks. A good thing, too, because the powers that be had put him to work the minute he'd gotten up out of that hospital bed. The battle with the Chang'e had been costly, and many of the Order's strike teams, including Echo, Bravo, and Delta, had been decimated. Riley was the only man still on active duty out of Echo's four-man command unit. Sergeants Nick Olson and Sean Duncan had both perished during that last op. Olson at the hands of the Chang'e, and Duncan while fighting the fallen angel known to the Templars as the Adversary. Riley's friend and longtime commander, Cade Williams, was still alive, but had been forcibly retired as a result of the actions he'd taken in the wake of the Chang'e assault. As a highly decorated member of the Echo Team, as well as one of the Order's most senior surviving non-coms, Riley had been tapped by the Preceptor to rebuild the strike teams to operational capacity. Over his protests, he'd been put in charge of Echo itself and elevated in rank all the way to captain. When word of the escape had come down from Bennington, the Preceptor had immediately ordered Riley to the crash site. Riley had been told that he was the logical choice. Not only had he been part of the squad that had captured the Necromancer, but he was one of the few surviving Templars who had faced the Necromancer in personal combat. When Riley had calmly pointed out that he'd lost that encounter, his objections had been overruled, and he quickly found himself aboard one of the strike team's Blackhawks headed for the crash site. Staring down at the wreckage now, he was overcome with a sense of dread so strong that for a moment all he wanted to do was turn around and climb back aboard the helicopter, leaving this mess to someone else. He shook off the feeling, slung his HKMP-5 on its sling around his back, and grabbed hold of the rope that was being offered to him by Martinez, one of the men under his command. With a nod to the others, he started down. Less than 5 minutes later, Riley and his three companions stood on the floor of the ravine, staring at the wreckage of the bus. The partially caved-in roof, as well as the various dents and scrapes that bore evidence to the bus's journey down the hillside, were expected, but the massive rips in the metal, rips that looked suspiciously like giant claw marks, were not. The sight of them gave Riley pause. The advance team had confirmed that the vehicle in the ravine was the long-overdue bus, but had not ventured down to the ravine floor to look for survivors. Riley's first instinct was to rush forward and see if there was anyone left alive in the wreckage, but he quelled the notion before acting on it. The men, including Riley, were dressed in standard Templar tactical gear that included dark ceramic body armor worn under black jumpsuits of flame-retardant material without markings or insignia, lightweight Kevlar tactical helmets with built-in communications gear along with audio and video recording devices, and military-style combat boots. Each man was armed with a Heckler & Koch MP5SD submachine gun, an HK Mark 23 45 caliber handgun, and the holy sword they'd been given at their investiture into the Templar ranks. Not wanting to give their exact positions away by speaking, Riley ignored the tactical communications gear and used hand signals instead, sending Ortega and Simmons toward the front of the vehicle while he and Martinez headed for the rear, their weapons out and at the ready. The bus had landed right side up and perpendicular to the slope of the hill so that they were approaching it from the passenger side. They moved forward cautiously, their gaze jumping from the shadows around the bus to the darkened interior and back again as they watched for movement. So far, there hadn't been any sign of the transport team or their passenger, which Riley found unsettling. They rounded the side of the bus and got their first look at the back of the vehicle. The back end of the bus had been peeled open like a tin can, the jagged edges of the newly torn steel shining in the darkness. Just inside the vehicle, the shattered remains of the prisoner's enclosure reflected the light of their flashlight beams back at them, and they could see that the arcane symbols filigreed into the depths of the glass had been burned black from a surge of power strong enough to overwhelm their protections. That was all Riley needed to see to know that the necromancer had indeed escaped.
Cover me.
Riley moved toward the back of the bus. He could see Ortega and Simmons entering the vehicle from the front and felt confident enough to sling his weapon and use his hands to boost himself up into the back of the vehicle. As he climbed to his feet, he saw Ortega shine his flashlight on a seat closer to the front and then tense in surprise.
What have you got?
Blood. A lot of it, too.
Riley moved forward and added the beam of his flashlight to those of the other man. Ortega was right. There was a lot of it. It had splashed across the seats and pooled on the floor, and then frozen in a wide puddle that reflected the light with a ruby-red glow. But there was just blood, nothing more. If the men were injured, where had they gone? If they were dead, what happened to their bodies?
Spread out and search the area around the bus. Look for bloodstains, tracks, anything to indicate where they might have gone.
15 minutes later, they had nothing to show for their efforts but a chill that went deeper than the evening's coldness. The missing men had seemingly vanished into thin air. Riley moved a few feet away from his men. He pulled his tablet from his pack, fired it up, and then placed a video call to the man who had ordered him out on the hunt, Preceptor Johansson.
The bus was attacked, there's no doubt about that.
Riley went on to explain what they had found while searching the wreckage, and also to detail the efforts they had made to find the missing transport team.
Any sign of the prisoner?
No, sir, not a trace.
Riley waited for the preceptor to ask about the transport team that had been assigned to the bus, to no avail. The lack of concern for the missing men infuriated Riley, but he kept a lid on his anger. He answered several more questions the preceptor put to him about the condition of the wreckage, and then agreed to wait for the cleanup crew to arrive before returning to the commandery. As Riley slipped the tablet back into his pack, he shivered visibly, and not just with the cold. Hundreds of miles away, Preceptor Johansson disconnected from the call with Captain Riley and leaned back in his chair, his mind racing at a furious pace. The next 48 hours were critical, and he knew he needed to bring all of the Order's resources to bear if he wanted to recapture the escaped prisoner before something serious happened. He turned to one side, where his aide, a man named Hennessy, stood waiting.
What's the status on Strike Teams 2 and 4?
They're up and ready, sir. Standing by on a 5-minute alert status.
Good. Make sure the team leaders have been briefed on the prisoner's capabilities.
Yes, sir.
I want a scrying team assembled immediately. Have the prisoner's blood and DNA samples pulled from storage in case they're needed. That will be all for now.
Right away, sir.
One more thing, James. Inform Commander Williams that he has been reactivated effective immediately and assign him to the pursuit of the prisoner.
Sir?
You heard me, James. Reactivate Commander Williams. Restore his network privileges and access codes while you're at it so that he can access the mission briefing and Captain Riley's report when it is available. No sense sending the man out half-cocked.
Of course, sir.
As Hennessy left the room, Preceptor Johansson considered the decision he'd just made. It hadn't been an easy one. There certainly wasn't any love lost between him and the former Knight Commander. One of Williams's men had been captured in the wake of the battle with the Changshi several months before, and the Preceptor had refused to allow the Echo Team leader to attempt a rescue, instead ordering the portal to the Changshi stronghold in the beyond sealed for safety's sake. Enraged, Williams had tried to strangle the Preceptor. Only the swift action taken by then-Sergeant Riley, the same man now in charge of the Echo Team, had saved his life. But Riley had then turned around and damned himself by not arresting Williams when ordered to do so.
Oh, what a tangled web we weave.
Williams had disobeyed direct orders, taken an armed force back through the portal to do battle with the Changshi a second time. The Templars had emerged victorious, but both Williams and Riley had been lost in the fray. Johansson had kept his mouth shut when the two men were honored posthumously and their empty coffins buried with honors, figuring it made no sense to impugn the reputations of the dead. But when they'd miraculously turned up alive and well in the Arlington Commandery, he'd taken what he knew about their previous behavior to the Seneschal himself to see that they were punished accordingly. In the end, Williams had cut a deal. All charges against his executive officer, Sergeant Riley, would be dropped in exchange for Williams's immediate retirement from the order. He would be declared persona non grata and his name stricken from the rolls. Johansson's revenge had been spoiled slightly by the Seneschal, who had promoted Riley to Knight Captain and put him in charge of Williams's old unit, the Echo Team. But Johansson could live with that, given Williams's dismissal.
And now here I am inviting the fox right back into the henhouse.
It couldn't be helped, though. He may consider Williams and his unholy gifts a threat to the Order and to all it stood for, but the reality of the situation necessitated Cade's use. The Order had pursued the Necromancer for years before Williams had finally succeeded in bringing him to justice. With the Necromancer once more on the run, it made sense to bring back the one man who knew more about him and his motives than anyone else alive. Satisfied he'd made the right choice, the Preceptor picked up the phone to inform the Seneschal of his decision. Cade was in the kitchen, fixing lunch, when he felt the wards at the edge of his property flare briefly before settling back down to their normal state. He stepped over to the window and pulled back the edge of the curtain. A dark, government-looking sedan was making its way up the long drive toward the house. From this distance, Cade couldn't make out who was behind the wheel, but he wasn't particularly worried. Evil of the type he was used to dealing with rarely made a visit in a plum-colored sedan, though he recognized that there was always a first time for everything. Besides, the wards were designed to keep out anything from the infernal realms, which meant whoever was driving the car had to be human. He might have had some difficulty dealing with a minor demon or two on his own, but humans he could handle. He stepped to the end of the counter closest to the door and opened the drawer there, removing a .45 caliber handgun inside. There was no need to chamber around. The gun was kept loaded and cocked at all times. The gun was held casually in Cade's right hand, there if he needed it, but not overtly threatening. At least, it wasn't intended to be. He wasn't taking chances, though, not with what he had to protect these days, and he didn't give a damn if the other man felt slighted by the weapon's presence.
He's coming to my house. Here we play by my rules.
His visitor turned out to be a young man in his late 20s, dressed in a dark coverall that was decidedly military in appearance, despite its lack of unit patches or other insignia. His closely cropped hair and erect bearing added to the illusion. A casual passerby would register these details and in all likelihood conclude that the young man was either a member of the military or local law enforcement, which was precisely what the Order wanted them to believe. The Order might be good at hiding, but apparently they didn't listen too well. He'd told them he was done. He'd meant it, too. Cade just stood there with a calm expression on his face, waiting for whatever it was the other man had come here to tell him.
Knight Commander Williams. There's, been an incident, sir.
Cade still had a few friends among the Order's ranks, one good one in particular, and he hadn't heard about any incidents. Of course, the problem could still be unfolding, which would explain why he hadn't been forewarned about the messenger's appearance.
The necromancer, Simon Logan, has escaped.
Outwardly, Cade didn't react to the news, but inwardly he breathed a sigh of relief. For a moment, he'd been convinced something had happened to Riley.
Preceptor Johansson is recalling all formerly active duty personnel with experience in dealing with the necromancer to assist in the hunt. I'm here to escort you to the commandery.
No.
It was perhaps the last thing the young Templar expected to hear, and for a moment he could only stand there staring blankly as he tried to process Cade's response.
Sir?
I said no. I'm not going to the commandery with you, nor am I getting involved in a hunt for the necromancer.
Cade watched, privately amused, as the other man processed what he'd just heard.
Perhaps I'm not being clear.
Cade cut him off by stepping out onto the porch, forcing him back and away from the door in the process.
I understood you just fine, son. Now do us both a favor and get off my land before we have an incident of our own.
The young man opened his mouth to say something, glanced at the gun in Cade's hand, and apparently thought better of it. Cade had no doubt that the rumors would be flying fast and heavy within minutes of the messenger's return to the commandery, but that didn't bother Cade at all. Rumors had followed him most of his time in the Order. Sometimes they were even true. What's one more story to add to the heretic legend? Cade watched from the porch until the other man had driven out of sight around the bend at the far end of the road. Then, and only then, did he step back inside the house. Word of Logan's escape gave him more than a little bit of concern, and so he slipped the handgun into the waistband of his jeans at the small of his back rather than return it to its place in the kitchen drawer. He had other weapons stashed about the house, at least one in every room, in fact, but he felt better having one right at hand should he need it. Who knew? Those few seconds might make all the difference. He stepped over to the stove to check on the soup he'd been preparing just prior to the messenger's arrival. He spent a few minutes preparing a tray to take upstairs, adding a glass of water and a rose from the bouquet on the table to the bowl of tomato soup that he had set down in the center. Grabbing a spoon from the drawer and a napkin from the holder on the table, he lifted the tray and headed up the stairs.
Lunchtime.
Across the room, seated in front of the window looking out at the snow falling gently in the backyard, was his wife, Gabrielle.
The snow's beautiful, isn't it, love?
Cade walked across the room and set the tray down on a card table he'd set up earlier for just that purpose. Gabrielle didn't answer. Cade sat down on the chair opposite Gabrielle's and pulled the card table over between them. Picking up the napkin in one hand and the spoon in the other, he smiled at his wife.
I've brought you some lunch. It's your favorite, tomato soup.
Gabrielle did not turn away from the window. Did not, in fact, acknowledge Cade was even present in the room. Cade pretended not to notice. He scooped up a little of the soup with the spoon and brought the utensil closer to Gabrielle's mouth.
Here you are. Open wide now. That's my girl.
Gabrielle's mouth opened slightly as the spoon drew closer, and Cade slipped the food deftly between her lips, catching the little that dribbled out the side with the napkin in his other hand.
That's it. One bite at a time.
Little by little, spoonful by spoonful, Cade Williams fed his once-dead wife. Years before, when Cade had been an officer with the Boston Police Department, he and his wife had been attacked in their own home by a serial killer he'd been hunting, known as the Dorchester Slasher. The killer wanted to talk, to gloat, but Cade had dealt with enough men like that to know that things would only end badly if he gave in to the maniac's demands. Instead, he'd drawn his weapon and put a bullet through the killer's forehead. His swift action had saved both their lives. Until the thing living inside the killer's body broke free and attacked them in turn. Gabrielle had been killed in the first few moments of the attack, or so Cade thought. It wasn't until years later, after he'd discovered that the creature he'd known as the adversary was, in fact, the fallen angel Asherael, that Cade learned his wife was not quite dead. Her body held in some kind of arcane stasis, and her soul a captive of the adversary deep in the heart of the beyond. It was then that Cade had taken the fight to the enemy, had tracked the fallen angel to its lair on the Isle of Sorrows in the middle of the Sea of Lamentations, and with the help of his friends and fellow Templars, Matthew Riley and Sean Duncan, had slain the infernal creature and set Gabrielle's soul free. It had been Cade's fervent hope that when he returned to the world of the living, he would find his wife alive and well, her soul restored to its rightful place inside her now breathing body. But it was not to be. Instead, he'd returned to find her as she was now, a barely responsive shell of her former self. Her body functioned as it normally should. She ate, drank, slept, and the like, but there didn't seem to be anyone home. The spirit that had animated her, the very thing that had made her who she was, seemed to be missing, and Cade had no idea how to find it. Ever since the night he'd returned, he had been caring for her as one might an invalid, feeding her, bathing her, helping her with her bodily functions. While she slept, he continued his research, searching for a solution to the problem at hand. What the adversary had taken away, Cade was determined to restore, and he would not rest until his wife laughed and cried and spoke his name again. Gabrielle's presence here was the reason he'd turned the preceptor's messenger away. He didn't have time for the distractions of the order, no matter how much he might miss the rush of action or the companionship of his team members. Gabrielle had to come first. When he was done feeding her, he put the soup dish back on the tray beside him and picked up the copy of A Tale of Two Cities that he had brought up from the library earlier. Dickens had always been one of her favorites.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
Riley was standing in the preceptor's office at the Bristol, Rhode Island commandery, having just finished delivering his initial report on the necromancer's escape. Hennessy hurried into the room. Hennessy didn't even bother to look and acknowledge Riley's presence, just rushed over to the Preceptor's side.
Sir!
Whatever news he carried, it couldn't have been good. For Riley watched as the older man's face turned an unusual shade of red as his anger got the better of him.
How dare he!
The Preceptor turned his angry visage in Riley's direction.
Did you put him up to this? Just what in heaven's name does he think he's doing?
If I had any idea who or what you were referring to, I might be able to answer your questions completely.
That bastard Williams, that's who! He refused his reactivation order and threatened the life of a man I sent to deliver it. Just who in heaven's name does he think he is?
Refused his reactivation order? For a second, Riley had no idea what the Preceptor was talking about, and then it dawned on him. Johansson must have tried to call Cade back to active duty on some pretense or other to get him to hunt down the Necromancer. In an odd way, it even made sense. Cade was the man who had hunted down and then captured Simon Logan in the first place. If anyone knew how Logan thought, it would be Cade. Then the irony of the situation hit Riley full bore, and he had to work to keep the smirk off his face. Johansson himself had been the one to drum Cade out of the order. It wasn't surprising, at least not to Riley, that Cade had basically told Johansson to stick it when he'd been ordered back to duty.
I find it hard to imagine Knight Commander Williams threatening a messenger.
Are you calling me a liar?
Of course not, sir. I'm just suggesting that there might have been some miscommunication between Knight Commander Williams and the messenger you sent to speak to him.
Miscommunication, my ass, Captain! He did it deliberately, and I guarantee that he'll regret it when I haul his ass before the Seneschal for a disciplinary hearing.
Riley chose not to point out that it would be hard to call a disciplinary hearing against a man who was no longer part of the Order and therefore not subject to its discipline. Nothing like giving the idiot an opportunity to embarrass himself further.
Is there anything else, Preceptor?
I'm formally assigning Echo as the point team for tracking down the escaped prisoner and returning him to custody. I want regular email updates on your progress and expect you to make some headway rather quickly, Captain. Do I make myself clear?
Crystal, sir.
Excellent. Bennington has sent a courier with the blood and DNA samples taken when Logan was first admitted. They should be here within the hour. I've ordered a scrying ceremony to take place as soon as they arrive, and expect you to have your team briefed and ready to go as soon as the ritual is concluded and the Necromancer's location known. That will be all.
The man's pompous nature always got under his skin. He understood now why Cade had always avoided the headquarters commandery as often as he could, preferring to spend time at Ravensgate in Westport instead. Of course, that had been when the Echo team leader had reported directly to the Seneschal at the Order's headquarters in Scotland, rather than to the North American Preceptor.
Oh, how the times have changed.
As Riley made his way toward the conference room he'd commandeered for his meeting of Echo team, his thoughts turned to his friend, Cade. He'd told the Preceptor the truth. He didn't believe that Cade had outright threatened the initiate the Preceptor had sent to deliver the reactivation order, but he couldn't deny that his longtime commander had grown sullen and withdrawn in the wake of their defeat of the adversary and their return from the beyond. Hell, he was Cade's friend, and he didn't think he'd seen the man more than two or three times in the last 2 months, if that. They'd never really talked about what happened over there. He remembered the adversary taking over his body, forcing him to fight against his friend and fellow squad member Sean Duncan. He remembered how he'd screamed in rage and fear as his body had refused to obey his commands, as he'd watched his hands plunge his blade into Duncan's chest. He remembered the pain he'd felt when Duncan had stabbed him in the throat with his combat knife. After that, things got a little hazy. Because the two of them were still alive, he knew that Cade had defeated the adversary, but they'd never discussed the details. By the time Riley had recovered enough to leave the hospital, Cade had flown home and faced what could only be called a behind-the-scenes court-martial. His forced retirement had caused him to pull away from Riley as well, Cade not wanting to taint the other man with his own supposed sins. The Order had made a point of keeping Riley busy as well, which further worked to isolate them. When he thought about it, it almost seemed to Riley that their separation was intentional, but he didn't know if that was the Order's doing or Cade's.
About time I found out, isn't it?
The one time he'd gone looking for information about that final confrontation in the Beyond, he'd discovered that the after-action report had been sealed by none other than the Seneschal himself. Riley had been there, had been involved in the actual battle, and not even he was cleared to read it. He didn't like it, but there was little he could do about it. At least the Necromancer's escape would bring Cade back into the fold where he belonged. Riley didn't think he could stay away, knowing a man like Simon Long was on the run again.
Maybe when Cade does, things can get back to normal around here.
A short while later, Riley stood at the front of the conference room and looked out at the 12 men assembled there. Echo Team was made up of 4 squads of 4 men each, plus Riley's personal command squad, bringing the total to 16. Baker and the rest of the men from 3rd Squad were on assignment somewhere in Kentucky, which accounted for the missing team. Most of the men were veterans. Many had served in Echo under Knight Commander Williams and had been a part of the operation to bring the Necromancer to heel the first time around. When Riley had assumed command of Echo, he had made some personnel choices that had necessitated moving men from one squad to another. Manny Ortega and Jimmy Martinez had both been promoted to the command squad, leaving the 1st Squad without a commander. Riley had solved that by promoting Corporal Stevens, 2nd Squad's second in command, to sergeant and moving him over to run 1st. Empty slots in both squads had then been filled with the top men out of the latest training class to come back from Scotland. Riley got down to business.
Gentlemen, as some of you know, we had an escape from the Bennington Containment Facility last night. Simon Logan, former leader of the Council of Nine, a.k.a. the Necromancer, somehow managed to overcome the men assigned to his transport crew and escape while en route to the lockdown facility at Longfort. Echo's been given the job of hunting him down and returning him to the fine accommodations awaiting him at Longfort. Some of you were with Knight Commander Williams and I when we assaulted the Necromancer's stronghold in Louisiana and understand what we're up against. For the rest of you, Logan is the individual directly responsible for the attacks on both the Ravensgate and Templeton commanderies earlier this year. The Necromancer's powers extend far beyond what most of you are accustomed to dealing with, so understand that this isn't going to be an easy one. You've all been provided with a dossier detailing exactly what we know about the man and his abilities. I expect you to have it committed to memory by 1600 hours.
Riley glanced around, trying to gauge the mood of those in the room. Here and there, he saw a concerned expression, mainly on the faces of Echo's new recruits. But the rest of the men seemed to be taking it all in stride without a problem, which was no more than he expected. These men had seen combat in all its different forms, had come face to face with some of the most horrifying creatures known to man, from hordes of revenants fresh out of the grave to major demons summoned from the fires of hell itself, and did so without hesitation or fail. They were humanity's first and last line of defense against the things that hunted him in the dark. Recapturing the Necromancer was just another mission in a long line of such missions, stretching back to the earliest days of the Order's existence. They would stand in the gap and protect their fellow man because there was no one else to do so. It was that simple. Riley spent some time detailing what they had learned from the crash site, which admittedly wasn't much. Let them know that they would be heading out as soon as the scrying team had managed to pinpoint the Necromancer's location, and then dismissed them to see to their weapons and equipment. Until the scrying team did their job, there wasn't anything more to be done. The hair and blood samples taken from the Necromancer when the Templars had first incarcerated him arrived by mid-afternoon. Riley met the courier at the door personally, took control of the samples, and then walked them down to the ritual chamber where several of the Order's mystics had been preparing for the scrying ceremony for the last several hours. Mystics had long been a part of Christian tradition, and the Order had reluctantly embraced them hundreds of years before. Since that time, the use of arcane powers like those the mystics could command had become a standard part of the Order's response to supernatural threats and enemies. For without those powers, they were vulnerable to the abilities their enemies could bring to bear against them. Certain practices were more accepted than others, while some, scrying and protection magic, to name just 2, had become quite commonplace. The room in which the ceremony was going to take place looked like a bizarre combination of high-tech command center and a centuries-old place of religious worship. Several high-speed computers were networked together on a table in the center of the room and were linked to a 56-inch flat screen that was hanging on the chamber wall, while inscribed on the floor surrounding it all was a giant hermetologic protection circle that looked like it had come out of some ancient magician's text, which was precisely where it had come from. Acolytes from the information technology section manned the equipment, ready to jump in to solve any hardware or software issues that might erupt in the midst of the ritual. At the appointed time, the nine mystics filed into the room and took up their assigned positions around the great circle. Four at the cardinal points of the compass, and the others at positions that represented the points of a Star of David. Each man was dressed in a dark robe, tied at the waist with thick white cords, but the hoods of each robe were tossed back, exposing their features to all that were present. What they did here today was for the benefit of those they were sworn to protect, and there was no reason to hide their faces away in the darkness. Behind them came five other similarly dressed men who took up position kneeling in the center of the formation. Riley, standing opposite them, knew that they were there to step up and replace any of the primary participants if something went wrong. They would not be able to enter the circle once the ritual had begun, however, hence their position at the center of it all. Riley hoped they wouldn't be needed at all, but he suspected this ceremony would be tougher than most. They were, after all, going up against a necromancer with more than a little skill in such arts himself. The man standing at the point of the Star of David raised his hands in a posture of supplication and looked heavenward as his voice rang out.
Heavenly Father, blessed Redeemer, Creator and Protector of man, hear us, O Lord. Fill this place with your Spirit. Guide our hearts, our minds, our hands, as we seek to do your will this night. Turn your gaze upon the world and show us the one we seek.
As Riley looked down, he could see the hair on his arms standing on end in reaction to the power slowly building in the room.
Uriel, Angel of the North, Ancient One of the Earth, I call you to attend to us this night. I do summon, stir, and charge you to witness our rite and to send your blessings upon it. We ask you to protect our actions and guard us with your holy might.
A shimmering wall of light erupted from the floor and rose upward toward the ceiling, forming an arc of power between the speaker and the next man a quarter of the way around the circle. The light before Riley flared brilliantly and then faded slightly until it was just a luminescent glow, through which the other participants were partially visible. The ritual team didn't waste any time. As soon as the light had settled, the next man began speaking.
Raphael, Angel of the East, Ancient One of the Air, I call you to attend to us this night. I do summon, stir, and charge you to witness our rite and guide us with truth and precision. Bless our actions and guard us with your holy might.
The second quarter of the circle filled with light.
Michael, Angel of the South, Ancient One of the Flames, and General of the Lord's Armies, I call you to attend us this night. Protect us with your sword and guard us from the actions of the Evil One and his minions with your holy might.
The third quarter of the circle burst into flame. Riley could feel the ferocious heat of the flames on his face and hands for an instant and wondered how those who were much closer managed to bear it before it died away.
Gabriel, Angel of the West, Ancient One of the Waves, I call to you to attend to us this night. Cleanse us with your holy waters and make our hearts and minds full of the purity of your blessed strength.
The final portion of the protective circle flared to life, sealing the ritual workers inside its boundary. With the circle activated, nothing could pass in or out of its confines until the ritual either reached its proper conclusion or failed spectacularly. The mystics were committed now. There was no turning back. The real work of the ritual could now begin.
Beatus Archangels, suffragium nos in nostrum quest ut reperio atramones nos peto. Nos in genero vos per Deus abus, Deus filius, quod Deus spiritum sanctus.
Beatus Archangels, suffragium nos in nostrum quest ut reperio, atramones nos peto. nos ingero vos per Deus amas, Deus filius, quod Deus spiritum sanctus.
The computer screen at the back of the room suddenly flickered into life, displaying an image of the Earth as seen from space. Riley knew from previous experience that the image was being beamed directly from a network of satellites that the Order had put into orbit through a series of dummy corporations that had been set up for just that purpose. Other organizations had tried to unravel the ties between the shell companies in the past, all had failed. If need be, the Order could tap into any of the various government satellite systems orbiting the planet, but doing so allowed for the possibility of their covert use to be discovered. By creating a network of their own, the Order effectively minimized that risk, while at the same time providing an incalculable resource for use in its day-to-day operations. The image on the screen began to change. Slowly at first, and then with increasing intensity, the image shifted from one of the Earth seen from space to that of the North American continent, and then to the continental United States. The screens continued to shift and change, the view shrinking with each change as the mystics began to hone in on their prey. The image of the United States was replaced with one of the Northeast Coast, and then with a shot of the state of Connecticut. Riley glanced at the mystics, saw several of them swaying on their feet. Sweat rolled off their faces, and several of them had their eyes clenched tightly shut as they pushed harder toward their goal. From the way they held their bodies and the expressions on their faces, it was obvious that their prey would not come easy. Riley could easily imagine that the necromancer had used his own dark magic to try and make the task of finding him as difficult as possible. Still, they persisted. The screens flashed again. Gone was the map showing the state of Connecticut, and in its place was a map of Fairfield County. Riley felt his heart rate jump as his excitement grew. They were getting close. Riley turned just in time to see the man standing at the southern point of the compass collapse to the ground. The loose, fluid nature of his fall told Riley that the man was unconscious before he hit the ground. Thankfully, he fell forward and did not break the sanctity of the circle. Who knows what could have happened then? The man was barely on the ground before one of the others, who was crouched in the center of the pattern, took his place. On the screen, the image flickered for a moment, then solidified once more before drilling down another level to a map of the city of Bridgeport. The Templar mystics must have broken through whatever spell defense the necromancer had employed to keep them from tracking him, for things moved much more quickly after that. The focal point on the screen slid east, then west, then south, before settling on a section of the city down by the harbor. Another shift, and the map was replaced by a live satellite view of the same region. The screen gave the illusion that the camera was plunging earthward as the viewpoint zoomed closer. Riley recognized the area as being on the east side of the harbor, diagonally opposite the ferry landing. Like a hawk swooping in on its prey, the satellite view suddenly centered on a large fenced-in lot right along the water at the end of East Main Street. Several smaller buildings and one large warehouse were on the lot, but there were no cars parked nearby, and it looked like the place was not in active use. With a grim sense of finality, the view settled on the warehouse in the center of the lot.
Gotcha.
10 minutes later, Echo Team was airborne aboard the three Black Hawk helicopters Riley had arranged to transport them from Rhode Island to Connecticut. They would land at Sigorsky Memorial Airport inside the Bridgeport city limits, where they would transfer to a set of SUVs that local Knights would have ready and waiting. A few minutes after that, they would be breaking down the doors of the warehouse revealed in the scrying ceremony and hopefully taking the necromancer back into custody. The men of Echo, including Riley, were dressed in jumpsuits of black flame-retardant material worn over a set of ceramic body armor that had been blessed by the Holy Father himself. They carried the standard-issue HK Mark 23 45 caliber handgun, complete with a 12-round magazine, a flash suppressor, and a laser targeting device. Two spare magazines for the pistols were affixed with Velcro to their left wrists. A combat knife was either clipped to their belt or in a calf sheath on the outside of their boots. Their swords, recently blessed again during Mass, were slung across their backs, the hilt of the weapon extending just beyond their right shoulders for easy access. On their heads were lightweight Kevlar tactical helmets with built-in communications gear. Subtract the swords, and they could be mistaken for your average SWAT or tactical response team from any major agency on the planet, which was entirely the point. In fact, Riley carried false ID which identified him as Agent Wilson of the Department of Homeland Security's Rapid Response Team if he needed to discourage further investigation by a local law enforcement officer or nosy citizen. It was amazing what the public would accept in the name of national security nowadays, and it was a rare occasion when the order had to back up any of Riley's creative storytelling with some actual data.
God bless the Patriot Act.
Riley handed out copies of the satellite image of the warehouse complex to the men in his chopper and knew the squad leaders and the other two were doing the same.
The scrying ritual has put the necromancer inside this building here. Local eyes and ears on the ground have indicated that no one has gone in or out of the building since the satellite shots were taken, so we're pretty confident we found his bolt hole. I want first squad on overwatch protecting our backs while I take command and second squad with me into the building proper. Radio silence and hand signals only until we breach, then use TAC channel 9 for all communications. We're cleared for deadly force, so don't hesitate to put this son of a bitch down if given the chance. He certainly won't hesitate to use his powers against you. Take it from me. That's not something you want to experience.
Riley had been there with Cade when they'd last fought the necromancer. He remembered all too vividly the pain he'd felt when hit by a blast of power from the necromancer's staff, how he'd been lifted up and tossed away like so much trash. Granted, the necromancer wouldn't have the power of the Spear of Destiny at his beck and call this time around, but that didn't mean he wasn't a force to be reckoned with all on his own. This was not going to be an easy assignment.